Part 2. Modern Eliminationist Politics. Chapter 7. Sources and Patterns. Mass murder is a political act. It is not a frenzied outburst of crazed individuals. It is not the lashing out of a psychically or materially wounded collectivity. It is not a suprahuman or historically determined occurrence caused by prior acts of people long dead or continents away. It is not the mere expression of modernity's conditions or bureaucracies or the explosive result of social psychological pressures. It is not driven by the darker barbaric self supposedly within us all. And it is not the mere expression of one single man's or a small group of men's will, any more than other major political initiatives and policies are. Because mass murders and eliminations are political acts, to understand and account for them, we must reinsert them into our understanding of politics and fundamentally change or expand our conception of politics to include them. I do not mean merely that we need to say that such assaults are political, which is at once not recognized by many and treated as a truism requiring little elaboration or exploration by others. Instead, we must explore eliminationist programs' political complexities and integrate our understanding of them into a robust understanding of modern politics, domestic, international, and the intersection of the two. Thus, it is both true and not enough to say that an exterminationist or eliminationist assault is the result of a leader or leader's decision for political ends. We need to further recognize and explore the other factors influencing leaders and the considerations they take into account in making their political decisions to mass murder or eliminate others, explorations that should produce analyses as full and true to the project's enormity as those we give to political leaders' decisions about other major policies, everything from national economic initiatives and social programs to going to war. How do the eliminationist assault's political goals advance the leader's still large political aspirations and initiatives? Will slaughtering or eliminating the targeted groups be popular with their supporters? Do they have the requisite resources, personnel, and organizations? Is the time ripe for the initiative? What are the potential costs and the probabilities they will occur? How do the cost-benefit probabilities of initiating an eliminationist program compare to those of doing nothing, or of taking an entirely different approach to the perceived problems? Leaders contemplating mass murder and elimination are not all rational actors using sophisticated algorithms to calculate a complex matrix of variables, costs, and benefits before arriving at their decisions to expel or kill targeted groups or to repress or tolerate them. Politics does not operate so neatly, and neither does the politics of mass elimination. Moreover, however rationally more conventionally conceived politics seems to be practiced, particularly when the well-understood norms of power, wealth, or moral responsibility are dominant, eliminationist politics are often governed at root by eschatological or millennial orientations, fantastical beliefs, or intense emotions that render talk of rationality or even instrumental calculation misplaced. As we do with political leaders making other momentous decisions, including about war, we must neither treat eliminationist leaders as purely rational actors, nor neglect the rational calculations such leaders regularly make. War is a political act. Whatever their significant differences, so too are mass murder and eliminations. War is part of political leaders' repertoire. So are eliminationist and exterminationist politics. It would seem foolish to explain the outbreak of a specific war or wars in general by reducing them to ancient prejudices, supposedly trans-historical qualities such as the supposed barbarian within us all, the social psychology of small group life, or some invariable outcome of social structures such as capitalism or globalization. We understand that the decision to start a war is a choice by political leaders, a calculated choice taking into account many factors, including their often erroneous, prejudice-laden worldviews. We understand it is a choice that could be made differently and, in practice, has been made differently again and again, with leaders opting for non-military solutions to problems, effectively saying no to war. All this is true for mass murder and elimination. All attempts to explain, as ironclad cause and effect, why wars break out have failed. The contingency of the political, the irreducibility of leaders' decision-making, the intelligence, passions, and wisdom of particular leaders doom the quest for scientific-like causal explanations. They also suggest how misplaced and misguided the quest is. The high-stakes confrontation of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1961 demonstrates the foolishness of the notion that decisions to initiate a war or an eliminationist assault are foreordained by social structures or other forces. The tapes of the meetings in which American President John Kennedy and his advisors flail about while groping for a course of action should disabuse anyone of such an illusion. Most notably, Kennedy was under enormous pressure from American military leaders to strike Cuba, killing a projected 10,000 to 20,000 people and risking a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union. Kennedy said no. Beyond the contingency of political developments and processes, and of individual leaders' personal imprints on events, leaders are embedded in such different political worlds, in different historical periods and contexts, that factors that might tend to lead them to opt for war in one period or place do not in another. Moreover, individual wars' timing and character also cannot be explained in a generalized way. Neither can the outcomes, except perhaps in the most prosaic, though hardly trivial, sense of who wins. Take war's most catastrophic instance. World War II's major elements and features are not explainable without foregrounding the person, personality, intelligence, and pathologies of Adolf Hitler. Author's note. Similarly, the Bolshevik Revolution and all that followed, including Joseph Stalin's rise to power, likely never would have occurred had Lenin not returned to Russia from Switzerland. Even Leon Trotsky, an avowed Marxist, conceded this, which itself occurred only because of the cunning, strategically brilliant decision by the Germans to transport Lenin in 1917 from exile back to Russia so he could foment revolution and hasten Germany's defeat of Russia in World War I. In 1928, it was not inevitable that Germany would bring Hitler to power, or, in a decade, seek to conquer Europe and eventually the world. Had someone assassinated Hitler, or had any of many contingent historical developments turned out differently, then there would have been no war, certainly no apocalyptic war, and mass elimination that produced 40 million deaths. Even in 1933, when Hitler, as the leader of Parliament's strongest political party, became Germany's chancellor, war, let alone its timing, scope, course, and destructiveness, was anything but inevitable. The same can be said for 1938, when Germany was still weak, though by then, short of a military coup deposing Hitler, some military conflict was likely. Had the Allies not caved in to Hitler's demands at Munich, or had Stalin not made the disastrous calculations that led him, in August 1939, to sign a non-aggression treaty with Hitler and thereby give Hitler the green light for a general war, European and world history would have unfolded substantially differently. His armies then still relatively weak, Hitler might not have started a two-front war, the avoidance of which he had always understood to be the sine qua non of expansionist military success. Even if he had wanted to start such a war against the most powerful countries to the west and east, would he have judged his military leadership willing to follow? Would they have been? Or would they have balked at a seemingly disastrous course? If Hitler had nevertheless initiated a two-front war, would he have been able in the spring of 1940 to conquer France and knock Britain off the continent? If, alternately, Hitler, in the face of an antagonistic Stalin, had waited, with the Allies rearming, his relative military strength might only have deteriorated. How events would have unfolded is anyone's guess. The political and military developments of the late 1930s and 1940s were hugely contingent. Perhaps Germany would have been contained and Hitler deposed. Perhaps Germany would have been defeated in a more geographically limited war, sparing millions of lives. The only relatively certain major military development about World War II in Europe is that the United States' entry meant Germany was likely to lose, unless Germany developed nuclear weapons first. And without Germany's initiation of a general war, it is also likely Japan, standing alone against the American Colossus, a powerful Britain, and an unengaged, antagonistic Soviet Union, would not have attacked the United States and initiated a general Pacific War. Without Hitler, the visionary apocalyptic warrior, the world would have been substantially different, and in so many critical ways, unpredictably so. Two all but certain things are that there would have been no Holocaust, and no world war at any time remotely close to when it occurred, if ever. Other things are less certain. A powerful Germany, which likely would not have been democratic, would have continued to occupy the heart of Europe. An imperial Japan might have continued to uneasily coexist with East Asia, Britain, and the United States. The Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe would never have been established. The rapid post-war decolonization, owing in part to the war's mortal blows to the British and French empires, likely would have unfolded considerably later and more slowly. But how all this and much more would have played out is impossible to say. Hitler was a rational calculator, an astute adept politician, and an obsessive governed by a hallucinatory image of humanity and the world and of his megalomaniacal role in it, and a person operating under domestic and international political circumstances that constrained and enabled him. Yet nothing about Hitler's rise to power and decisions that led Germany and Germans and then much of the world hurtling to disaster can be understood without accounting for Hitler's cunning mind and calculations. Nothing about it can be understood without privileging his irrational elements, his personal pathologies, and his political beliefs, prejudices, and hatreds. And nothing about it can be understood without embedding it all in an understanding of politics, Germany's politics, in which ordinary Germans, resonating with Hitler's own beliefs and prejudices, played a substantial role, and international politics, including the domestic politics moving the major international actors. Just as leaders' decisions for or against war take into account a range of factors, including the prospect of winning and of being able to fight, whether they will receive compliance and support from those who must fight and from the broader population, so does the decision to practice eliminationist politics. In fact, leaders opting for mass elimination, especially extermination, depend significantly more on followers having supportive beliefs and values, for two related reasons. The cognitive, emotional, and moral threshold for killing unarmed men, women, and children ordinarily greatly exceeds killing enemy soldiers. And for waging war, there is a well-established, politically legitimate, existing institution, the military, that as a socially accepted practice prepares its members for fighting and for overcoming inhibitions, if any, in killing enemy soldiers. For eliminationist onslaughts, similar institutions and preparation are typically initially absent. So the intended perpetrators and the general populace have less formal preparation for overcoming the ordinarily greater inhibitions against slaughtering unarmed non-combatants, in other words, massacring civilian adults and children. Because the decision to pursue eliminationist politics, especially mass extermination, depends on the ready willingness of those in whose name the politics would be pursued, the decision in itself is obviously not sufficient to explain the perpetrator's participation. The great man view of genocide, best known for being applied to the so-called charismatic leader Hitler, and as an exculpatory argument to spare the perpetrator's character and responsibility from being probed, is obviously mistaken. Just as political leaders are critical for determining whether eliminationist onslaughts take place at all, they cannot do it, or, as seems often to be believed, will it alone. To understand the translation of their will into large-scale social and political action on the part of thousands, we need to move from analyzing the leader's and his circle's individual beliefs, values, and psychology, to considering broadly dispersed political and social beliefs and values. The same complex and multifaceted analyses that exist of major political policies, including war, must characterize investigations and understandings of eliminationist politics. The literature on either world war are examples. Take World War I. A vast body of scholarship and popular writing dissects and tries to make sense of why the war happened, examining all aspects that may have contributed to its outbreak, including political, social, economic, imperial, and individual psychological dimensions. Vast literatures examine the war itself in its every detail, the soldiers' lives, understanding, and motives, and the mobilizing of domestic support, the war's domestic consequences, and its aftermath. Standard political questions of leadership and followership, of the mobilization of resources, of institutional design and performance, of motivating the soldiers and the broader population for participation and sacrifices, are not assumed away. They are asked, by and large, without their answers being presumed or asserted with some agenda of inculpation or exculpation. The same could be said for World War II, the Vietnam War, the Iraq War, and a host of others. Compared to this, our treatment and understanding of eliminationist politics is analytically thin and one-dimensional. The same telling comparison could be made by looking at the complexity and multidimensionality of how other more humdrum aspects of American politics are investigated, whether it is the New Deal, the Civil Rights Movement, the Reagan Revolution, or the politics of health care during the administration of President Bill Clinton. We must stop detaching mass elimination and its mass murder variant from our understanding of politics. We must stop thinking it is sufficient for historians to describe the events themselves and then posit some reductionist explanation, or for social psychologists to reduce it to social psychology, or for diversionists to attribute structural causality and responsibility to abstract institutions or to systems far removed, either in time, such as long-gone colonizers, or in space, such as global capitalism, from the agents of violence and death and the countries of their destructive deeds. Eliminationist politics, like the politics of war, is a politics of purposive acts to achieve political outcomes, often of ultimate ends and often of desired power redistribution. Only when we recognize this can we begin to understand the varied phenomena that compose eliminationist politics and respond better to them politically. This suggests that there is no single explanation for mass murder, or more generally, mass elimination. Eliminationist politics has many diverse aspects. Some resist general or systematic explanation, others do not. Some lend themselves to probabilistic statements. Some fall into patterns that can be analytically usefully categorized. Our task is to make sense of eliminationist politics' various aspects, or at least as much sense as each allows. We have seen that eliminationist politics are an extension of politics by other means, but are they really an extension? The history of our time suggests that eliminationism is actually integral to politics, as its diverse forms and policy options have often been used and are readily available. Interstate war has become exceptional. Yet violent domestic conflict, including civil wars, domination, and repression, are commonly practiced around the world, and eliminationist politics, including mass murder, is conceptually and as a matter of practice on a continuum with other violent domestic forms of control and suppression. The number of those dying because of eliminationist politics is vast. The number of instances of such politics being practiced is too numerous to easily count. The number of moments that eliminationist politics have not been practiced during our era is zero, and the instances where its most violent and lethal forms of mass expulsion, incarceration, enslavement, and killing have not been practiced also number zero. The number of countries and groups having either practiced eliminationist politics or had such violence practiced upon them is enormous. Without a thorough reckoning of eliminationist politics' character and effects, our time's history dating from the 20th century's beginning, many of its major geopolitical developments, and states and society's constellation today cannot be understood properly. Eliminationist politics have shaped Europe's and Asia's maps, and the histories, social compositions, and politics of the world's most populous countries, and so many smaller ones. Each of the 10 most populous countries, China, India, the United States, Indonesia, Brazil, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nigeria, Russia, and Japan, and the European Union, which, with regard to mass murder during World War II, has shared experience and relatively common consciousness, has perpetrated or been the victim of large-scale, nationally traumatic, murderous eliminationist politics. Author's note: Brazil may be the exception insofar as Brazilians' destruction of the country's indigenous peoples may not have imprinted Brazilians' consciousnesses as profoundly as the other eliminationist assaults have other peoples. In recent history, mass murder has deeply scarred countries home to 4.4 billion people, two-thirds of the world's population. Imagine mass murderers had targeted you, that somehow you had managed to escape, or they had merely driven you from your home or imprisoned you in a camp and brutalized you, or you had lived for years fearing they might kill you. Or imagine eliminationist executioners had targeted and merely brutalized or actually killed your family, ethnic group, community, or co-religionists. Or imagine that you lived in a community where such executioners had so targeted, brutalized, or killed people of other ethnicities or religions. How would any of these circumstances of your life, how would these horrors that engulfed you and or those around you, scar or mar you? If imagining rampaging mass murderers seems far-fetched, imagine hooligans had broken into the house next door and brutally beaten and murdered your neighbor, and his son had seen it happen. Think of how it would indelibly transform the boy's life. Think of how it would affect yours, knowing what had befallen your neighbor and how that boy, whom you see daily, had to bear the daily burden of being fatherless and having witnessed such brutality perpetrated on his father and thereby on him. These are the eliminationist politics and acts that have worsened and coarsened the existence of billions of people alive today. Such politics have been mainly the province of non-democratic regimes. Even so, democratic regimes succeeding them must pick up the pieces, process, including by suppressing knowledge of what has happened, and live with exterminationist and eliminationist assaults, society-deforming and personally devastating consequences. If we understand eliminationist politics as a constituent feature of politics and of leaders' available political repertoire, and realize that eliminationist beliefs and hatreds have existed broadly among many countries' leaders and peoples, then the attack's high instance and victims' staggering number are not so startling. Modernity and Eliminationist Politics. Just as our time's politics have differed from those of previous ages, so too have the eliminationist politics. Although a complex interactive relationship exists between a specific country's politics and society, we can identify several political factors that crucially contribute to the initiation and character of our time's mass murders and eliminations. 1. Features of modernity itself and of the modern state. 2. Structural relationships that exist domestically within countries. 3. International contexts or environments. 4. Beliefs about certain groups and understandings of politics and society that lead leaders and followers to think eliminating those groups desirable. 5. Proximate factors that produce the opportunity and the will to take the political step of turning eliminationist desires into actuality. In discussing these political factors, we can explore eliminationist politics' broader outcomes, some of which are by now familiar. What has been the character of our era's mass murder and eliminationist politics, and why has it differed from that of other periods? Why have our time's attacks occurred? What do eliminationist programs have in common? How do they vary? Why do perpetrators treat different victim groups differently during a given eliminationist program? Examining eliminationist politics through these wide-angle and narrowly focusing lenses reveals similarities and identifiable patterns in mass murder and eliminations' causes and mechanisms, and various differences in the results, some patterned, others not. Modernity, a defining aspect of which is the modern nation-state, has features promoting and informing our time's eliminationist and exterminationist politics. Among the modern state's distinctive qualities is its enormous and unprecedented power to transform the physical and social world, dwarfing anything states could do even in the 19th century. This is owing to the modern world's gargantuan growth technologically and industrially, and also to its equally prodigious, though much less recognized, growth in organizational sophistication and means of control, and knowledge about society and how to shape it. A concomitant distinctive feature of our time is the transformative visions and related transformative ideologies that political leaders and their followers develop. 18th and 19th century states, American, German, Japanese, Russian, were essentially caretaker entities that pacified their territories, governed them lightly, if often brutally, and had as a principal activity raising taxes to finance small bureaucracies and militaries, safeguard the privileged classes, and facilitate industrialization to various degrees. Much of the 19th century globe, conquered and subjugated by European imperial powers, lacked indigenous states or substantial political capacities. Our era's states ever increasingly are comparative institutional behemoths, with the resources, staff, communications, and organization to do, figuratively speaking, infinitely more for or against society and its members. The capacity to transform the world, to think not just about ruling over the territory in which people live, but also about shaping and governing the people themselves in every aspect of their lives, produces an orientation that can give rise to powerful transformative politics. Modern leaders can, in a practical sense, consider governing hundreds of millions, even billions of people, and not just loosely being sovereign over territory, but of controlling social, economic, and cultural life, even down to the family unit. They can, in a practical sense, think of slaughtering millions across large geographic areas. They have the power to change the social and economic order in radical ways and relatively quickly. They can create a blueprint to fundamentally refashion societies socially and culturally, which they can, confident of substantial success, decide to implement. Many transformative projects, communist, Nazi, nationalist, ethnic, religious, and others, face real or imagined human impediments, groups of people putatively standing in the way or who, as a matter of definition, must be eliminated. This modern political mindset includes a particularly modern political aesthetic of design and control. The mindset's fundamentals characterize democratic and non-murderous regimes no less than non-democratic and murderous ones. But when wedded to other ideas, which happens especially frequently among non-democratic regimes' rulers and supporters, this modern political aesthetic can lead to plans for recrafting society, a wish for purity as it is conceived, and intolerance of perceived imperfection or deviation. The most striking example of this eliminationist and exterminationist dreaming, planning, and implementation is, as with much else under discussion here, the Nazis. In January 1942, months after the Germans had already moved into the systematic extermination phase of their eliminationist assault against the Jews, Reinhard Heydrich, who was in charge of the program, convened a meeting of leading officials from the relevant state and governmental ministries to discuss their participation. Heydrich itemized country by country, including ones not yet conquered, such as England, Ireland, Switzerland, and Turkey, the number of Jews they would slaughter. Mass murderers often make lists of people they intend to kill, but they are usually lists of individuals or members of a political opposition or a targeted people's elite. In the vast annals of eliminationist politics, there has never been, except in this one instance, a formal document itemizing country by country across a continent the millions of people slated for extermination. The German leadership had embarked on a program to slaughter more than 11 million Jews. Modernity has bestowed upon the nation-state an increased communicative and learning capacity. Particularly starting with the second part of the 20th century and continuously accelerating, political leaders learn quickly of others' policies and measures and their successes or failures. These include policies and techniques of control, repression, and elimination. Our era has produced among political leaders, and even if unconceptualized, among publics around the world, a much greater consciousness about eliminationist politics' normalcy and practical efficacy, from erecting camps — both the Soviets and Nazis were inspired by the British concentration camps for the Boers — to mass murder. Many mass murderers or would-be mass murderers have explicitly referred to previous genocidal killers' models, starting perhaps with Hitler himself invoking the slaughter of the Armenians, and continuing to political Islamists today, who, when contemplating their hoped-for annihilation of Israel's Jews, regularly refer admiringly to the Germans' exterminationist assault on the Jews, often lamenting that the Germans did not finish the job. The Holocaust, commonly referred to by the Nazis' favorite euphemism, "the final solution," is by far the model most frequently invoked by would-be mass murderers. This is so probably for many reasons: the Holocaust's notoriety, its unequivocal annihilationist character, and the Jews' continued status as targets for Arab leaders, media, and thinkers, and for political Islamists more generally, which only further increases the renown of Hitler, the Nazis, and the Holocaust among those contemplating killing others. While the nation-state's real power has made imagining, planning for, and then undertaking eliminationist politics a frequent and often practical activity, these conditions of greater power and greater transformative and destructive vision have themselves not produced our time's mass slaughters and eliminations. A second structural political condition of modernity has turned standard antipathies and antagonisms into the basis for eliminationist politics. Prior to the advent of modernity, and particularly the 20th century, humanity was mainly in a pre-political state. Most people were not part of politics. They were cowed or quiescent subjects of emperors, kings, and nobles, not citizens or even potential citizens of countries. There was no real sense that people could govern themselves or participate meaningfully in their lives' political governance, so they demanded few goods or services from their rulers, who had little capacity to supply them. This was so not because people were individually incapable of self-governance, but because the political and social structures did not allow for it. It was a pre-democratic time. There could always be rebellions from within or invasion from without. Yet authoritarian governance's fundamental legitimacy was, almost everywhere, not an issue. Indeed, authoritarian rule over a country's or region's depoliticized population was often sacralized by the so-called divine right of kings or churches. It was the unquestioned, perceived natural order. In our time, every person is a citizen or a potential citizen. Every person is mobilized or potentially mobilized into politics. Political leaders face much more dissent and potential dissent than the rulers of pre-democratic times did. In the modern world, if leaders are unwilling to accommodate the populace's demands, including those of its different groups, then the leaders must be prepared to quell the dissent. Governing leaders and the groups that support them, who oppose democracy or a necessary degree of universalist pluralism, inevitably will have their rule and their regimes contested by people determinately seeking democracy, self-determination, or pluralism, and a minimum fair portion of society's economic product and social benefits. Leaders of non-democratic regimes know this. Such political leaders also know that those pressing for fundamental political and economic change, including possibly self-determination and territorial secession, will not easily cease, and repression's costs will likely grow. In the modern world, leaders of dictatorships of all kinds are therefore prone to using increasing repression and violence, which, being on a continuum with elimination's other forms, tend to make leaders want to solve their self-conceived or self-created problems in a definitive and final manner by eliminating putatively problematic people. Modern dictatorship, requiring increasing repression and violence, produces a totalitarian logic and drive. Political leaders and their regime perceive the need to penetrate society ever more pervasively to control as much of social life as possible. As repression and control increase, the stakes for the power holders and their followers grow, and the enmity of the repressed similarly deepens. The totalitarian impulse thus exacerbates modern dictatorships' already inherent tendency to resort to eliminationist politics, because it leads those in power and those benefiting from existing politics to perceive more and more social or political conduct as threatening, and to fear the consequences of a political reversal of fortune ever more intensely. Within the modern nation-state, systematic political and social tensions exist, making for high-stakes conflicts conducive to eliminationist politics and practice. In all countries, economic development and people's mobilization into politics create enormous strains. Enormous population growth in many countries further leads to intensive competition over scarce resources, including farmland in developing countries. These strains often produce a zero-sum politics, where one group's benefits come at the expense of another's. This in itself makes consensual and democratic politics a more difficult art to practice and sustain, and therefore tends to produce a politics of domination and repression, which inherently include an eliminationist impulse. Nation-building and its attendant challenges and problems have produced a second set of widespread strains. Nation-building requires political leaders to create a common sense of national belonging sufficient for a modern polity to function without state-rending conflict. Most acutely, problems of nation-building have existed in the states that emerged after decolonization. Many of them were artificial in the sense of suddenly being composed of ethnic and religious groups thrown together with little in common, except sometimes their competition, if not enmity, for one another. These states were torn not only by internal social and political conflicts, and also cross-border conflicts with neighboring states into which the same ethnic or religious groups had been split off, but also by their people's generally poor preparation for managing a state in the modern world, a world of politically mobilized peoples and of transforming 18th century economies into 20th century ones. Nowhere has this problem been more visible and deadly than in the Central African region containing Rwanda, Burundi, and Congo, where different ethnic groups, most notably the bitter enemies Hutu and Tutsi, have cohabited in desperately poor countries and also split up among them, leading to repeated, serial, and sometimes colossal instances of mass slaughter. This region, like almost no other, can be characterized as being in a semi-permanent state of eliminationist politics. In such states, civil war, or even smaller-scale internal conflict, tends to produce eliminationist inclinations because the enemy, even when vanquished, will still regularly contest power and therefore be threatening. The challenges of nation-building or any kind of structural conflict, including those caused by economic development and modern inclusive politics, do not in themselves produce eliminationist responses or eliminationist responses of any particular kind. That is dependent on other factors discussed shortly. Nevertheless, these challenges and conflicts have given powerful impetus to one group or another, one set of rulers or another, to opt first for repressive politics and then for a politics of mass elimination. This has particularly been the case because such conflicts tend to produce eliminationist ideologies that then organize political thinking, strategies, and action. In our era, when norms of universal rights, self-determination, and democracy prevail, and economic and social change is a constant, non-democratic politics and regimes are qualitatively different from previous eras. Today, they have a built-in propensity, a real one and not just a hypothetical one, to adopt eliminationist politics, including their lethal variant. This propensity is so embedded in the structure of contemporary non-democratic rule and tyranny that we must conceive of non-democratic and tyrannical regimes as inherently proto-eliminationist, even exterminationist, and respond to them politically, as discussed in Chapter 11, in a manner reflecting this. As the previous chapter's discussion shows, the international political environment critically influences the incidence of eliminationist assaults. When we consider that during our time the international context has generally been, as it was in previous ages, permissive toward such politics, we see more clearly why our age has been so mass murderously combustible. The international context's contribution to enabling eliminationist politics has been still worse during our time. The international environment's earlier permissive baseline toward eliminationist politics was due to states and international institutions' hands-off approach to other states' eliminationist politics. Our time has probably seen more deviation from this baseline in encouraging mass murder and eliminations than in discouraging them. Modernity's international system has provided yet another distinctive impetus to make our time's eliminationist politics unusually deadly. Modernity creates a transformative capacity and mindset that includes an eliminationist component. The structural conditions of modern non-democracies and tyrannies inherently produce intensive political conflicts, often resulting from the dislocation of nation-building and of economic development. These conflicts create a propensity on the part of such systems' inherently insecure power holders, drawing on their great capacities and inspired by their eliminationist notions, to adopt eliminationist solutions to eradicate political challenges and social unrest. But these structural conditions are only a portion of the eliminationist equation. Some proximate conditions, when present, tend to make leaders more likely to consider practicing and then adopting eliminationist politics, and, when absent, tend to militate against such politics. Note the word tend. These paths are not determined. Precisely because they are not, we must return to the topic of why leaders decide to initiate mass murders and eliminations. The decision to eliminate people cannot be reduced to factors beyond the beliefs, personality, psychology, and moral character of the decision makers. Nevertheless, some factors render this decision more or less possible and probable. Most leaders deciding to eliminate groups of people are fervent in their desire. Many are fanatical, but they are not crazy in the sense of being incapable of assessing the practicality of implementing their wishes. These men have managed to rise to power, a feat all but impossible to accomplish for any but a pragmatic practitioner of the possible. Hitler is a quintessential example. Having succeeded in a few years in turning a political party of 24 into a mass movement, becoming Germany's chancellor through the ballot box, and consolidating power into an immensely popular dictatorship, he then set out to fulfill his ideological program by exterminating and eliminating millions of people. Even then, he carefully waited for the right time and opportunities to implement his murderous plans step by step. Whatever their differences, our time's other mass-murdering political leaders, Mehmet Talat and Ismail Enver, Stalin, Father Joseph Tiso, Anton Pavelich, Mao Zedong, Haji Muhammad Suharto, Idi Amin, Pol Pot, Augusto Pinochet, the junta leaders in Argentina, Mengistu Haile Mariam, Rios Montt, Hafez al-Assad, Slobodan Milosevic, Saddam Hussein, Teonesta Bagosora and the other Rwandan Hutu leaders, Omar al-Bashir in Sudan, and many more, were similar human amalgams of cunning and evil, adept Machiavellians, and hate-filled destroyers of targeted portions of humanity, against which they conducted a one-sided war. Because annihilationist and eliminationist assaults against large population groups are not trivial or routine undertakings, leaders must have a profound reason to pursue policies that could damn them among humanity's worst criminals. Some vision of a fundamentally transformed society provides them with the idea and the drive to eliminate groups of people instead of responding to real or even imagined conflicts with negotiation, accommodation, and compromise, or even, if deemed necessary, with lesser repressive measures. Whatever the particular rationale for mass elimination, whatever the particular conception of the intended victims, almost always there is at the root a complex of thinking that amalgamates three related, though by no means congruent, notions: the need for absolute control, the desire for purity, and the imperative to prevent the apocalypse. This radical anti-pluralist mindset seeks to forge a society of extreme, even total obedience, to regulate social and personal life, to purge domestic and sometimes international society of social and human impurities, and to fend off the catastrophe that putatively dissenting or impure people will bring about, hence a frequent apocalyptic mentality and commensurate action. Some variant of this mindset has been integral to most of our time's eliminationist campaigns. The specific belief's nature, from Nazi to communist to nationalist to racist to religious, that governs leaders bent upon eliminating, typically lethally, unwanted groups, varies greatly. And the differences matter enormously in their eliminationist programs. But they share, without being reducible to, this radical intolerance complex. Still, some are more intolerant than others. Certain movements and regimes, Nazism, various communist regimes, and today political Islam, discussed in Chapter 10, distinguish themselves among those who wanted and want to remold society as eliminationist intolerance's champions. These movements share three critical characteristics. First, they require conformity from people that many are unable to or would never want to fulfill. For the Nazis, most of humanity's putatively immutable racial inferiority disqualifies them. For the communists, different social classes and groups were not ready or able to march in lockstep with history. And for the political Islamist, the powerful corrupt infidels will never acquiesce to political Islam's stultifying political religious creed and practices. Second, these movements' visions for society's transformation require its utter purification. For the Nazis, in different ways, different racially disparaged groups posed various severe threats. For communists, until they realized the communist utopia, recalcitrant social groups always threatened counter-revolution. And for the political Islamists, God's will demands that all people serve him and live according to his political Islamic law. Third, these movements conceive of their visionary transformations as necessary in their own societies and transnationally, ultimately for all humanity, because only then, for each movement differently, would harmony follow. These visions lead to the need to bring the world in line and extirpate all that is deemed recalcitrant, what the Nazis called Gleichschaltung. To create total unanimity of thought, meaning total conformity, what the Soviets called Yedinomyshleni. Or to compel everyone to live according to strict laws allowing little room for personal freedom or deviation, what the political Islamists call Sharia. In each case, they reverse democratic pluralist society's basic creed, as all non-democratic and tyrannical regimes do to varying degrees. The democratic creed is, "He who is not against me is for me." Those not actively attacking their government or fellow citizens, breaking or seeking to tear down society's laws, no matter how they otherwise choose to live their lives, are respected and allowed to exercise their political and civil rights and follow their own notions of personal freedom of thought, conscience, and conduct. The creed of such visionary and radically intolerant dispensations as Nazism, various communisms, and political Islam is, "He who is not for me is against me." Anyone unable to or refusing to fall in line behind the prescribed transformative vision is an objective enemy who cannot be tolerated but must have the recalcitrant part of himself, or if that is not possible, then the person as a whole, eliminated. Each movement has conceived of much, though not all of humanity, as Immanuel Kant's crooked timber, out of which he declared, "No straight thing was ever made." Each, in its own way, cannot abide unstraightened human timber, and thus seeks to break and recast humanity, casting much into history's garbage heap, and reshape and refasten the remaining portion according to each movement's respective Procrustean notions. Thus, their thoroughgoing eliminationist desires and assaults, Nazism's Herculean destructiveness, Soviet, Chinese, North Korean, and Khmer Rouge communism's permanent purge, and political Islamists' call to kill millions, which some have already begun to execute. The Khmer Rouge's maxim applies to them all. What is too long must be shortened and made the right length. With the added fact that for each, much of society and the world is too long. When any leader, politician, or person speaks the language of absolute control, purity, or earthly or otherworldly apocalypse, he reveals a potentially eliminationist and exterminationist mindset. Still, this drive to eliminate targeted groups in itself is not sufficient for a program to be enacted. Leaders must believe that they can act with a high probability of success before they will risk initiating mass murder or elimination. Otherwise, their policy would be self-defeating. Leaders must believe that three conditions for success appear likely. They must have access to them. This is usually not a problem when, as most are, the victims are a minority in that country. They must judge that they can act with impunity domestically. They must also believe they can act with impunity internationally, so their eliminationist program will not be self-defeating, triggering powerful outside intervention. This, in particular, is why war often serves as the best context for undertaking pre-existing eliminationist desires. As Talat and Enver explained in a memorandum to German officials in which they discussed the Armenians' elimination, "The work that is to be done must be done now. After the war, it will be too late. During war, states have difficulty knowing what is happening within combatant countries and can more easily maintain or feign ignorance about mass murdering, which reduces domestic and international pressure on them to intervene. War itself, whether interstate or civil or counterinsurgent, usually places a country's leaders at maximum risk, so the added danger to them of implementing an eliminationist campaign is small. Thus, war and domestic military conflicts frequently alter the cost-benefit calculus, finally tipping the scales in favor of eliminating the hated groups, or become the domestic and international pretext for leaders to set in motion their willing followers, who are still easier to mobilize with even more plausible accounts for why, during war, the country must eliminate its enemies. Mass murder and eliminations are, as those contemplating them understand, both high-risk strategies because the danger for the political leaders undertaking them is enormous, and low-risk strategies with high payoffs because political leaders undertake such campaigns when they expect success. When circumstances such as war or domestic civil conflict can be engineered to decrease the additional risk of moving against hated groups, then the time has come for the would-be perpetrators to act, and to act in accordance with their and their followers' pre-existing eliminationist beliefs and with concrete strategic and often detailed tactical plans. This includes creating new eliminationist institutions or designating existing ones for eliminationist operations, mapping out, as in a military campaign, operational zones and attack plans, and drawing up categories, often prioritized, of people to be slaughtered or expelled, and specific lists of people, including enemy elites, to be especially targeted. Such politically conscious and pre-existing concrete exterminationist and eliminationist measures guided the Turks' murderous assault on the Armenians, the Germans' eliminationist assaults on Jews and many others, the Indonesians' slaughter of the communists among them, the Pakistanis' butchery of Bangladeshis, the Serbs' various eliminationist onslaughts of the 1990s, and many other mass slaughters and eliminations up to and including the political Islamic Sudanese's assault on Darfurians. In Rwanda in December 1993, 4 months before the Hutu leaders' plans to annihilate the Tutsi were put into effect, the Rwandan journal Le Flambeau published inside information about the training and planning given to the paramilitary Interahamwe, which in its outlines proved to be accurate. We learn today with the greatest stupefaction that these Rwandese Tonton Macoute, the brutal henchmen of the murderous Duvalier regime in Haiti, will implement a plot which the plotters will pass off as a civil war. The day of 20 December 1993, other sources talk of 23 December 1993, will be the fatal day of the final solution. Let us recall that the Nazi Germans and their chief Hitler baptized the operation to exterminate those they considered as the enemy of the blossoming of the Aryan race, notably the Jews, the final solution. Rwandese fascists and their chief have decided to apply the final solution to their fellow citizens judged enemies of the regime. This refers to their political adversaries, defenseless populations, but also, and above all, those who have seen the hand of the regime in the latest massacres of the population.